Good afternoon, people. Welcome. Great crowd. Are you all here for the Shakespeare or just to get out of the heat? Either case, we're glad to have you. I looked up a few quotes. I couldn't find Shakespeare on heat. He had that wonderful sonnet about comparing thee to a summer's day, but maybe it wasn't this kind of a summer's day he had in mind. But in any case, thank you. I'm Ken Sullivan, and on behalf of the West Virginia Humanities Council, welcome to the historic 1836 McFarland Hubbard House. Welcome to the second of our four little lectures for 2017. The council has presented the little lecture series each year starting in 2001. After today, we have two more talks in the 2017 series. May 21, the story of Henderson Hall Plantation by Henderson Hall director Randy Modisett. And on June 25, West Virginia Musicians and the Nashville Sound by WVU professor Travis Steinling. He'll be talking about Charlie McCoy in particular, I think, if we've got any harmonica fans in the house. We invite you to join us in the sunroom for refreshments following today's talk. Refreshments graciously provided once again by former Humanities Council board member Jennifer Soule. Today's speaker, is Concord University Associate Professor in English, Gabriel Rieger. Dr. Rieger is an Ohio boy originally with an undergraduate degree in English, as well as a master's in history and a master's in English literature from the University of Toledo. He received his PhD in English literature from Case Western Reserve University. Since 2008, he has taught at Concord, where he has also served in various other capacities, including faculty vice president, chair of the Committee on Research, co-advisor of the Film Society, and as a PI target in the Relay for Life PI, a professor event. I don't know what we're having for dessert, but you may get your turn. Dr. Rieger lives in Athens with his wife Irene and children Margaret and Alan. He has also taught at the University of Toledo, Bryant, and Stratton College, Cleveland State University, Case Western Reserve, and Gettysburg College. His published works include books, papers, articles for Ashgate Publishing, Syracuse University Press, Manchester University Press, and other publishers and periodicals. He has presented at many professional meetings, including the Blackfriars Conference, Ohio Valley Shakespeare Conference, the Shakespeare Association of America, the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, and the Group for Early Modern Culture Studies. He served as textual editor for the Appalachian Shakespeare Project since 2010 and editor of the selected papers of the Ohio Valley Shakespeare Conference from 2013 to this year. He's been the executive director of the Appalachian Shakespeare Project since 2009, while also involved as an actor and director. I'm very pleased to report that the Humanities Council has helped to support outdoor productions by the American Shakespeare Project in past year, the Appalachian Shakespeare Project in past years. Now, won't you please join me in welcoming today's speaker, Dr. Gabriel Rieger. Welcome.
I can't prove it for certain, but I strongly suspect that serving as a PI target may have made the difference in my tenure. I can't prove that, but it's a strong suspicion I have. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First, I'd like to thank Mr. Payne for inviting me to speak today. I'd like to thank Mr. McFarland for that wonderful introduction today. I'd like to thank all of you good people for coming out to see me today. My talk this afternoon is titled Why Shakespeare Matters, and with your kind consent, I'd like to begin in the best tradition of Renaissance rhetoric with an argumentum ad verecundium, with an appeal to authority. Specifically, the authority in this case is Gene Simmons, singer, guitarist, founder of the rock band Kiss, and God of Thunder. I was told that the speakers don't typically bring PowerPoints to these presentations, and indeed I don't typically work from a PowerPoint, but if I had, this would be the moment to provide a really spectacular visual, but I didn't. At any rate, according to Mr. Simmons, and I'm going to paraphrase here just a bit, quote, "I think that Shakespeare is trash, absolute trash. He may have been a genius for his time, but I just can't relate to that stuff. These and thous, the guy sounds like a sissy. End quote. Now, in fairness to Mr. Simmons, his original statement was a bit more colorful than my paraphrase just now. And while it does turn up in various places, I first encountered it in an anthology of quotations many years ago, I've yet to find a single definitive source for it. Nevertheless, I wanted to begin with that quotation today because that quotation epitomizes some of the chief complaints against Shakespeare, and perhaps against literature generally. Shakespeare is obscure, Shakespeare is antiquated, and Shakespeare is of questionable relevance to the modern world. Now, obviously, I do not share those sentiments. I'm the executive director of the Appalachian Shakespeare Project, and I've devoted my life to the study of Shakespeare's work and to the study of medieval and Renaissance literature more broadly. I do not share Mr. Simmons' sentiments, but I can understand them. And I want to explain to you just briefly why I say this. William Shakespeare died 400 years ago last April. We can date his death precisely on the 23rd of April, 1616. He was a prominent landowner and public figure at the time of his death, so the date of his death was noted. The date of his birth has been settled by scholarly consensus, but his death we can date precisely. I tell you this because William Shakespeare lived and wrote four centuries ago, and his world is not our world. Shakespeare wrote in and for a world wildly different from our own. Shakespeare's world was a world in which news traveled at the speed of a horse, and the destinies of nations were still settled with cannon and sword. International diplomacy was still undertaken in Latin. And Thomas Jefferson, who will essentially invent the modern state, will not be born for another 200 years or so, give or take. Jefferson's born in 1743. It's 179 years after the birth of Shakespeare, 127 years after Shakespeare's death. To drive home this difference, as if it needs to be driven home, I sometimes introduce my Shakespeare courses, these are my senior level Shakespeare courses at Concord University, with a handful of questions, beginning with, habes omne vestre libre? Habes penses omne vestre libre? I'm looking out now to see if any of you, if there are any other Latinists here in the crowd. Right? Yes, a couple of you are. Good. Nodding your heads to that. If the students express confusion, or as is more likely, they sort of humor me by pretending confusion, I'll follow up by asking, well, don't you understand Latin? Hasn't all of your education been in Latin since you were 6 years old? Didn't the old schoolmaster beat you bloody with a birch rod if he ever caught you speaking English in the classroom? So I might follow this question up by asking, well, how did Harry do last night? Harry hunts the bear at the Beckley Bear Pit. One night a week, they tie the bear to a stake in the middle of the pit, and then they sick starving dogs on him to take bets on how many dogs he can kill within a set span of time. Lastly, I might ask the students, well, are the heads still on display? The heads of the traitors, are they still stuck up on the sharp pikes along Vermilion Street? That's the main drag of Concord University's campus. Or have they finally sort of fallen apart and dropped into the street? The students have typically taken the point by this time, and honestly, they've taken the point well before this, but it sometimes amuses me to go on for a while. It is difficult for us to arrive at any authentic understanding of Shakespeare's works because we can never authentically understand the world that produced them. Our world is very different from the world of Shakespeare and his audience, and this makes any authentic understanding of his works all but impossible. Or perhaps I ought to clarify here. We cannot experience the works as Shakespeare and his audience experience them, and so we must experience them differently. We can't arrive at any authentic 17th century understanding of Shakespeare's works, and so we must settle for an academic or a historical or a personal understanding of them. In the 21st century, we engage the works of Shakespeare at a remove. Beyond this, and perhaps even more to the purpose, Shakespeare's language, brilliant though it is, and I want to talk at some length about his language, particularly in the second half of my lecture today, Brilliant though it is not entirely our language. I often tell my sophomore students who are taking their world literature survey, I teach the first half of the world literature survey at Concord, it's ancient, medieval, and Renaissance world literature. Well, I often tell my sophomore students, many of whom are encountering Shakespeare's language for the first time, imagine how our language has changed in the past 10 years. Imagine slang that people used when you were kids that nobody uses anymore. And now try to imagine how much the language changes in 400 years. Reading Shakespeare's language is challenging, not to say difficult. For those students who choose to study Shakespeare, rather few are going to go on to study at the graduate level. And of those who do study at the graduate level, rather few of them will ever earn their livings by engaging with Shakespeare or with literature generally. Certainly, no one earns a bachelor's degree in English, a Bachelor of Arts in English, and sets up shop in a storefront reading sonnets and plays. Shakespeare emerged as the foundation of English language education in an era when higher education was a luxury reserved for wealthy aristocrats, and its chief purpose was to make them better rounded, which is a phrase my students sometimes resurrect if they're asked to defend the liberal arts. And yet, having said all of this, I'm going to argue today that Shakespeare still matters, and that Shakespeare ought to remain a vital part of the canon of American education. And there are a handful of reasons why. One reason is that for all that Shakespeare's language is challenging to us, and of course it is, Shakespeare essentially invented the language we are speaking today. The scholarly consensus is that William Shakespeare coined, and this is this varies from scholar to scholar, but the consensus is that he coined in the neighborhood of about 1,500 English words, words which did not exist before him. There's some question as to how you divide those words and the precise numbering, but in the neighborhood of 1,500. Now, to offer some perspective, the average adult native speaker of English has a working vocabulary of about 20,000 words. Shakespeare invented 1,500 English words which did not exist before him. These include words that are used today in business, such as advertising, employer, manager, investment, and retirement. Words used in law, such as circumstantial evidence, divest, foregone conclusion, premeditated, and petition. And words used in politics, such as backing, negotiate, protesters, misquote, and pander. It's one of my favorite political words, but coined by Shakespeare. These are in addition to words that are in common usage today, such as bedroom, blanket, moonbeam, quarrelsome, and well-behaved. West Virginia even owes our beloved mountaineer to Shakespeare. Shakespeare coins that word, mountaineer, as a description of the Prince Guiderius in Act 4, Scene 2 of Cymbeline, one of his late romances. Give me just a moment, folks. Now, Shakespeare was able to do this, to effectively reinvent his language, for a couple of reasons. One of which is that he probably is the greatest linguistic genius who ever put pen to paper in English or in any other language. But there are other reasons as well, one of which is that, and a chief reason, is that Shakespeare was writing at a point in history when the English language had not yet been solidified. After Samuel Johnson publishes the first definitive dictionary of the English language, about 150 years or so following Shakespeare's death, the English language loses its malleability. And that kind of linguistic and etymological play that Shakespeare undertakes in his plays becomes essentially impossible. To provide you just one example of this, in Act 3, Scene 3 of Othello, when Othello, suffering all of the torments of jealousy, cries out, quote, "O now forever, farewell the tranquil mind, farewell content," end quote. Well, he's appropriating a Latin adjective there, tranquillus, which meant calm. Now, in Latin, the adjective was generally applied to the ocean. Id est tranquilla mare, the tranquil sea, or the tranquil ocean. Shakespeare adapts the adjective in English, and in doing so, provides a vivid physical description of Othello's mind, and a description that would have been familiar to most of Shakespeare's audience, because anyone in his audience who had had even a grammar school education would have had that education in Latin. They would have recognized that adjective in Latin. Shakespeare adapts it into English. Once the parameters of the English language have been solidified after the publication of Johnson's Dictionary, that's in 1755, once the parameters of the language have been solidified, that kind of coinage becomes a lot more difficult. So that's one reason why Shakespeare matters. Shakespeare matters if you have an interest in our shared language and its history. I remind my students, even when they struggle, Shakespeare is the inheritance of every English speaker. Whether you're a native speaker or whether you acquire English as a second language, you have the right to Shakespeare. He is your inheritance. That's another reason why I believe that Shakespeare matters. But I don't believe that it's the most immediate or even the most important reason, certainly not insofar as the modern university is concerned. Another reason why I believe that Shakespeare matters is that, not to overstate the matter, I have this written in my lecture, not to overstate the matter, and it occurs to me that while I believe it's relatively difficult to overstate Shakespeare, it is easy, particularly with my undergraduate students, to sound as if I am overstating Shakespeare. So, not to overstate the matter, Shakespeare essentially invents our modern notion of character. By that I mean, Shakespeare's characters have, I think the word we would use is interiority, in a way that previous characters simply did not. Now, to be certain, there existed complex characters before Shakespeare. You think of the heroes of Sophocles and Euripides in ancient Athenian drama, or of Virgil's Aeneas, or the pilgrims in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. They are all complex characters. None of them, however, have distinct interior selves in the way in which Shakespeare's characters have them. And I want to defend that claim here in a moment. Think, for example, of Richard III, who passionately woos the Lady Anne, if any of you are familiar with the tragedy of Richard III. He passionately woos the Lady Anne, invites her to kill him if she must reject him, and then, close of the scene, confides to the audience, "I'll have her, but I will not keep her long." You might also think of Hamlet affecting his antic disposition, pretending to be mad before the court, but expressing his true intention to the audience in soliloquies and asides. And these are two devices that Shakespeare and his theater exploit just to masterful use in the construction of character. The soliloquy, in which a character stands alone on the stage and speaks directly to the audience, essentially allows the audience to read the character's mind. A soliloquy, the spoken alone, essentially allows the audience to read the character's mind. When Hamlet speaks to the audience alone on the stage, we realize that he's not performing for any other witnesses. He is speaking to us directly. This essentially allows the audience to read the character's mind. Shakespeare exploits the device to a masterful effect. The soliloquy then changes not only how the audience reads the characters, but also allows the characters to construct themselves in ways that Aeneas, for example, was really never able to do, or at least not in the same way. Likewise, the aside, which occurs when a character breaks his conversation with another to address the audience directly, so quite literally the two characters speak on the stage, one of them stops, turns aside, and speaks directly to the audience. That device allows for, if it's used correctly, if it's used in the way that Shakespeare does, allows for levels of irony and levels of character which were all but impossible prior to its emergence. You might take, for example, Act 1, Scene 2 of Hamlet, when the usurper Claudius refers to the prince as, quote, "my cousin Hamlet and my son," end quote, and Hamlet replies, quote, "a little more than kin and less than kind," end quote. Remember that scene, we're going to be returning to it here momentarily and look at it more closely, but note what's happening in that exchange. We're privy to two levels of character here. One level on which Hamlet suffers the king's familiarity, and another on which he subverts it. Shakespeare allows us, particularly through the use of the soliloquy and the aside, Shakespeare allows us an unprecedented engagement with the interior lives of his characters. And he exploits that interiority for the purpose of character development. Now, a number of critics have addressed that phenomena. I'm going to simply cite one, Harold Bloom, who goes so far as to credit Shakespeare with what he calls the invention of the human. So, Bloom writes, quote, "Literary character before Shakespeare is relatively unchanging. Women and men are represented as aging and dying, but not as changing because their relationship to themselves has changed. In Shakespeare, characters develop rather than unfold, and they develop because they reconceive themselves," end quote. Perhaps analogous to this is the process that the critic Stephen Greenblatt calls self-fashioning, the conscious creating of an autonomous or semi-autonomous self, which Greenblatt, at least, identifies as one of the defining social forces of the Renaissance. And I should tell you, that's a fairly influential notion that Greenblatt pioneers. He pioneers this in a book called Renaissance Self-Fashioning that he publishes in 1981 and effectively redefines literary criticism from that point going forward. He invents this discipline that we call New Historicism. Another name for this phenomenon is subjectivity, the sense of the self as an autonomous subject, the sense of one's own subject position. Not coincidentally, Greenblatt charts the rise of this phenomenon as roughly coeval with the rise of the Renaissance theater. This idea doesn't really exist prior to Shakespeare. The philosopher and historian Alfred North Whitehead famously writes that, quote, "The safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato," end quote. If this is true, I would argue that we might also characterize the entirety of the Western humanities tradition as introduction and perhaps footnotes to Shakespeare. I think that's another reason why Shakespeare matters. I think it's another reason why Shakespeare matters, but once again, I don't think it's the most immediate reason. Certainly not if I'm attempting to persuade my undergraduate students of Shakespeare's value. And this might be a point at which to note that we in the profession have traditionally not done a good job of articulating the value of Shakespeare or of literature generally to our students. Maybe I'm only speaking for myself here, but it's an observation. I'm thinking of a colleague of mine who was recalling one of her professors in graduate school who referred to his subject, he was a professor of literature, referred to his subject as cocktail party trivia. Now, this was doubtless intended to be a bit of sort of self-deprecating humor, but it did a grave disservice to his and to my profession, because the phrase suggests what we might call the cocktail era of history, an era when education was an amusement, and it was social class that actually sort of set the course of one's life. Well, that's an era that's as remote to most of my students as is the Roman Empire, or perhaps the Renaissance. My undergraduate students tend to view their educations in more or less utilitarian terms. They want an education that will make them more marketable when they are seeking employment. Now, as an academic, as a professor of the humanities, I can feel any way I like about that, but it's simply a reality of the modern university. Some students come to college out of a core intellectual curiosity, but most of my students come to the university in order to better their employment prospects. Intellectual satisfaction is an agreeable side effect, perhaps. So what has Shakespeare to offer students such as these? Well, rather a lot, as it happens. It'd been rather a short talk otherwise, I suppose. Anyway. So when I introduce my literature surveys, which are required of all Concord University students, regardless of their majors, I often ask my students to state their majors and what they hope to do with those majors, and then I ask them why the university requires a literature survey. And while I can string that out a little bit with them sometimes, the answer is that, well, respectfully, while I care very little about whether or not my accountant or my physician or my daughter's guidance counselor can analyze the subtext of Hamlet, I care very much about whether or not those people can think critically and adapt their minds to evolving circumstances, and that is what the study of the humanities and of Shakespeare specifically provides for us. And you need not take my word for this. According to a recent, this is 2015, survey undertaken by the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, the employment rate for recent graduates in the humanities is 91%. that is a rate comparable to majors in business and the STEM fields. Yes, indeed. Raise a fist indeed. A rate comparable to majors in business and the STEM fields, and it's actually, for what it's worth, a tenth of a percentage point higher than majors in computer science. Some of my students find these statistics surprising. They are not surprising, however, to those of us who work in the humanities. As Susan Adams, writing for Forbes magazine in 2013, points out, employers seek candidates, quote, who have a broad knowledge base, who can collaborate to solve problems, debate, communicate, and think critically. Those are all skills that humanities programs insist students learn before they graduate, end quote. The late Steve Jobs phrased the matter even more eloquently at the launch of the iPad 2 in 2010, when he declared, quote, it's technology married with liberal arts, married with humanities, that yield the results that make our hearts sing, end quote. For most of human history, since Aristotle first considered the matter, all the way back in the 5th century BC, the chief justification for the humanities, and for literature specifically, has been utilitarian. The idea that literature will somehow elevate us and make us better people, or, in Aristotle's construction, better citizens. In his Defense of Poesy, written in the late 16th century, the English poet Sir Philip Sidney writes that poetry, quote, is speaking picture, with this end to teacheth and delight, end quote. Sidney sees these two objectives as complementary. The student is so delighted by the art of poetry that he or she scarcely notices that he or she is being given instruction. Okay, this then returns me to Shakespeare, and one of my favorite of Shakespeare's tragedies, albeit one that's not so frequently performed as some of his others, the tragedy of King Richard II. I have a handout here that I'd like to distribute. How should I best go about this? Yeah, sometimes I just sort of hand them out and pass them around. They sometimes make their way all around the classroom in my undergraduate survey. Sometimes they get caught up somewhere, but I have faith in the good people. I think they'll make it this time. The play has fallen a bit out of favor with 21st century audiences, at least or broadly speaking, perhaps in part because it is a history play, and audiences today are less familiar with medieval English history. As Dr. Ralph Cohen, who's the director of the American Shakespeare Center, writes, quote, it has less sex, less comedy, and less action than any of Shakespeare's other plays. The detail of its content, 14th century English history, and the political issue at its heart, the divine right of kings, is not currently stirring the blood of America's adolescents, end quote. Yeah, I don't get the kids today, but what do I know? This is unfortunate, in my opinion, because the tragedy of King Richard II really speaks to the human condition in a fundamental way, particularly as regards matters of desire and loss. For those of you who are unfamiliar, King Richard II was a bad king, both tyrannical and feckless, and he was deposed by his cousin Henry Bolingbroke, known thereafter as King Henry IV. In Shakespeare's tragedy, however, a funny thing happens once King Richard is deposed. In the best tradition of Shakespearean tragedy, think Hamlet, King Lear, Macbeth, Richard gains perspective in trauma. That perhaps brings us to the selection which you have before you on the front of your handout. I apologize, are there any extras left, or are we lost out? If I can grab just a quick one, I'm so sorry, because I wanted to read this for you, and alas, poor planning on my part, I thought I had this to hand. So, Henry Bolingbroke. Are you content to resign? Are you contented to resign the crown? King Richard II. I know, no, I, for I must nothing be. Therefore, no, no, for I resign to thee. Now mark me how I will undo myself. I give this heavy weight from off my head, and this unwieldy scepter from my hand. The pride of kingly sway from out my heart. With mine own tears I wash away my balm. With mine own hands I give away my crown. With mine own tongue deny my sacred state, with mine own breath release all duty's rights. All pomp and majesty I do forswear, my manners, rents, revenues I forego, my acts, decrees, and statutes I deny. God pardon all oaths that are broke to me, God keep all vows unbroke that swear to thee. Make me that nothing have, with nothing grieved, and thou with all pleased, that hast all achieved. Long mayest thou live in Richard's seat to sit, and soon lie Richard in an earthly pit. God save King Harry, unkinged Richard says, and send him many years of sunshine days. Thank you so much. So, let's take a look at this. Richard's answer to Bolingbroke, the first line, puns upon the two senses of the word I know no I. Puns upon the two senses of the word I, the personal pronoun and the statement of affirmation, A-Y-E, and the two senses of the word no, the expression of knowledge, K-N-O-W, and the statement of negation. Richard is either vacillating between agreeing or refusing to resign the crown, yes, no, no, yes, or he's expressing a sense of what we might call subjective disorientation. I know no I. I don't know myself. Or he's expressing the fundamental dissolution of his own subjectivity. I know no I. I know there is no I because I'm not the king anymore, and so I must nothing be. The folio, perhaps following the lead of the fourth quarto, and this tragedy was published in multiple quartos, which attests to its popularity and sort of a contentious history that it had in its own time. And I can tell you more about that during the Q&A if anybody's curious. But the folio, perhaps following the lead of the fourth quarto, underscores the pun by using the form of the personal pronoun in both instances. As the critic M.M. Mahood notes, and he's writing in 1957, quote, Richard's reply, besides suggesting in one meaning his tormenting indecision, and in another the overwrought mind that finds an outlet in punning, also represents the meaning I know no I. Richard's pathetic play-acting, his attempt to conjure with a magic he no longer believes. Can he exist if he no longer bears his right name of king? End quote. Well, from that point in the scene, as you can see, Richard uncrowns himself, essentially undertaking his coronation in reverse. He invites us to mark how he will undo himself, effectively undertaking an ironic blazon, the description from head to toe. An ironic blazon, describing himself from his head down, disassembling his kingship as he does so. Take a look at your handout, beginning with line 204. I give this heavy weight from off my head, and this unwieldy scepter from my hand, the pride of kingly sway from out my heart. At every turn, Richard himself removes the trappings of kingship, ironically underscoring his power as he does so. He needs must be a king in order to create, or in this case, uncreate, a king. His disavowal of royal identity ironically evinces that identity. He goes on to describe how, quote, with mine own tears I wash away my balm, with mine own hands I give away my crown, with mine own tongue deny my sacred state, with mine own breath release all duties rights. Only the physical body of the king, the sacred physical body of the king, is sufficient to dismantle kingship. All right, at 211, having ironically reinforced his status as a king, albeit a king deposed, Richard shifts his rhetoric and his focus, declaring, quote, all pomp and majesty I do forswear, my manners, rents, revenues I forego, my acts, decrees, and statutes I deny. Note how in deposing himself, Richard ironically highlights the inadequacy of Henry. Henry requires Richard to depose Richard. Henry cannot forswear Richard's pomp, forego Richard's rents, or deny Richard's statutes. Only a king can deny these things. Everything that Richard says carries with it at least the implication of its own opposition. And from line 214 on, that opposition becomes even more pointed. Richard says, God pardon all oaths that are broke to me. God, keep all vows unbroke that swear to thee. Make me that nothing have with nothing grieved, and thou with all pleased that hast all received. Now, Richard, having uncreated himself as king, effectively creates Henry as king. He conveys the kingship to Henry. But note the imagery he evokes in order to do so. God, pardon all oaths that are broke to me. We are reminded here that a kingdom's worth of oaths have been broke to Richard. Lords have consistently switched their alliances from Richard to Henry to this point in the tragedy. He has systematically lost all of his support. God, keep all vows unbroke that swear to thee. Now that Henry is king, the vows of the people are sworn to him, and implicitly will carry just as much weight as those sworn to Richard. Richard invites the new king to, quote, make me that nothing have with nothing grieved, and thou with all pleased that hast all achieved. Richard has lost his kingship, and with it everything, but ironically, this leaves him with nothing grieved. Now we can interpret the syntax of that line in one of two ways. Either he is grieved because he has nothing, or perhaps he is not grieved. As he is with nothing grieved, he has nothing to grieve him. If we read the line in its second sense, then the following line, thou with all pleased that hast all achieved, allows for a potentially ominous opposition. Thou with all pleased, we might read as pleased with everything, pleased with all, since Henry ostensibly has everything that he desires. However, in at least one of the quarto editions of the tragedy, the sixth quarto, which was published some 18 years after Shakespeare's death, that phrase, with all, is rendered as one word, withal, W-I-T-H-A-L, which in the 17th century carries the association likewise, or as well as. Is Richard then acknowledging that Henry is withal pleased? It as he's pleased because he has everything. Or is Richard suggesting that Henry is pleased in the same way that Richard is pleased? And having the kingship, he likewise has nothing. If we adapt this ironic reading of the line, then the lines which follow take on an ironic force as well. When Richard wishes to Henry, long mayest thou live in Richard's seat to sit, and soon lie Richard in an earthly pit, God save King Harry, unkinged Richard says, and send him many years of sunshine days, the lines are colored by his own deposed condition. He speaks from the position of unkinged Richard, and he hopes that Henry may live in Richard's seat to sit. This is the same as to say that the earthly pit gapes for Henry as it does for Richard. If Richard is a king who can be deposed, then Henry as king can be deposed as well. Furthermore, Richard's entreating of sunshine days for his rival carries the dual association of kingship. The sun was a conventional association of English kingship in medieval heraldry, and also evanescence. Sunshine days is a proverbial phrase in the Renaissance referring to pleasures which are short-lived. Richard's ostensive blessing then switches back easily into a curse. It sort of flickers between the two meanings, depending on our perspective. So, note what we've done here. We've read through Richard's deposition very carefully and made note of the ways in which his language, at every turn, evinces its own instability, inviting us to hear or read it in multiple and often contradictory ways. In literary studies, we refer to this process as deconstruction. Now, deconstruction is a method of reading which was pioneered in the 1960s by the French philosopher and linguist Jacques Derrida, a name that's probably familiar to some of you. Derrida argues that all language carries within itself its own opposition. So according to Derrida, so a quote from Derrida, in a classical philosophical opposition, we're not dealing with the peaceful coexistence of vis-a-vis, but rather with a violent hierarchy. One of the two terms governs the other, axiologically, logically, etc., or has the upper hand, end quote. Now, this methodology can get just as complicated as we want it to be, but for our purposes, I think this fundamental understanding will probably suffice. The surface meaning of Richard's deposition speech, that is to say, I have lost everything and Henry is better than I am, is subverted into, collapsed into, or perhaps it's just inextricable from, potential alternate meanings. E.g., I retain the essential power of kingship because only a king can depose a king. Or, I relinquish the illusion of kingship to you, and may you suffer with it as I have suffered. So what does all of that gain for us? And what implications does any of this have for my initial question of why Shakespeare matters? Well, this fine parsing of language that we've just undertaken speaks to the fundamental question of the tragedy of King Richard II. What is a king? Is kingship divinely ordained? Richard declares in 3:2 that, quote, not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm from an anointed king. The breath of worldly men cannot depose the deputy elected by the Lord, end quote. By the time we reach 4:1, however, Richard has been deposed by, quote, the breath of worldly men, end quote. His state is beholden to Henry, and Henry's claim to the kingship is just as precarious now as was Richard's, more so, in fact. Because Richard at least inherited by was king by inheritance. Richard's language simultaneously endorses and subverts Henry's intended narrative of the transfer of monarchical power. And all of this gets forecast in that initial chiasmus, that initial crossing, I know, no I. Following that scene then requires the reader or the viewer to recognize at least two simultaneous levels of meaning and maintain them simultaneously. Note here then the kind of, what shall we call it, intellectual gymnastics, I guess, that Shakespeare requires of his audience. Shakespeare demands us to stretch our minds and our understandings of language as well as our understandings of character and identity in order to successfully navigate the scene. And we can. Shakespeare sets us up to successfully navigate the scene. He presents us with a challenge, but it's certainly not an impossible challenge, and it's a challenge that Shakespeare facilitates through Richard's diction, through the structure of his language, through its parallels, its echoes, its ironic inversions. Bearing that in mind, I'd like to take a look at another passage. This is the one provided on the obverse of your handout. It's a short selection from Act 1, Scene 2 of Hamlet. Unlike Richard II, Hamlet is among the most familiar of Shakespeare's plays, and it's all but universally regarded as the greatest of his tragedies. King Lear is the other contender, perpetual contender for that title. I assume the essential plot line is familiar to everyone, but just to provide some context for the scene, in this passage, King Claudius, who has murdered his brother, Hamlet's father, and who has married his sister-in-law, Hamlet's mother, is attempting to ingratiate himself with the prince, Hamlet. Sounds rather convoluted when you describe it that way, doesn't it? Well, anyway. All right, so let's take a look at that. Claudius begins his address at line 266 with the line, quote, but now our cousin Hamlet and our son, to which the prince replies, in aside, a little more than kin and less than kind. Well, we've already addressed the role of the aside in constructing character. But now I'd like to take a look at the prince's language, specifically that pun on the words kin and kind, which would have been pronounced similarly on Shakespeare's stage. Shakespeare writes Hamlet, and the current critical consensus is right around 1601 or so, when the English language is in the final stages of the great vowel shift. And some of you are probably already familiar with this. I can chat more about it during the Q&A if any of you are curious. Here, I've got an actual footnote here on my talk that I could go down to, but we'll let that go. All right, how might we read Hamlet's reply? Well, that depends upon his implied subject. If the implied subject of Hamlet's reply is Hamlet himself, well, we might read that reply such that, being both cousin and son, Hamlet is more than kin to Claudius, but is nevertheless unlike him, it est his not of his kind. That's one reading. On the other hand, if we read the implicit subject as Claudius, we might read the reply as suggesting that while Claudius is now more than kin to Hamlet, Hamlet nevertheless regards him as less than kind. That is to say, Claudius' usurpation of the role of the father is unkind. Of course, occurring as they do in a single line, those two meanings collapse into one another, effectively inverting Claudius' attempt to ingratiate himself and underscoring that fundamental separation between the two. So, Note what Shakespeare has done here. He's managed to develop the characters of both Claudius and Hamlet and provided context for their evolving relationship, which will prove integral to the plot, all within that span of two lines. The exchange continues in a similar vein in lines 68 and 69. Claudius asks Hamlet, quote, "How is it that the clouds still hang on you?" end quote. And Hamlet replies, "Not so, my lord, I am too much in the sun." Claudius' query is a reference to Hamlet's mourning suit. He's still dressed in black. His mourning suit, which is conspicuously out of place while the court celebrates the wedding of Claudius and Gertrude. Hamlet's reply appropriates Claudius' metaphor and, once again, inverts it. Echoing Claudius' previous construction of him as sun, Hamlet puns upon the word by invoking the homophone sun, the brightest of the heavenly bodies, which shines through and dispels the clouds. As before, there are at least two possible readings of this line. One reading works ironically, as a declaration that, contrary to Claudius' assertion, no clouds hang on Hamlet because he is too much in the sun. It asks the glory of the king, note that heraldic association again, dispels all of his sadness. Another reading appropriates Claudius's metaphor to a more pointed effect. Hamlet cannot express his sorrow because he is too much in the sun. That is to say, his proximity to the new king inhibits his implicitly natural and proper expression of mourning, an expression of mourning which, pointedly, only Hamlet is expressing. Hamlet makes this reply directly to the king. You'll note he did not speak in an aside here. So the actor portraying the king could react to it in any number of possible ways. And that question becomes even more compelling when we note that the next line comes not from the king, but rather from Gertrude, who interrupts the scene in order to, well, what is she trying to do here? Attempt to perhaps assuage their hurt feelings, to head off temper here. Hamlet's mother, Gertrude, perhaps hoping to prevent conflict, inserts herself into the conversation at line 70, advising Hamlet to cast his knighted color off and let thine eye look like a friend on Denmark, since it is common all that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. Gertrude's line allows Hamlet to appropriate her language in much the way that he has appropriated Claudius's language, and to a similar effect. When he concurs with her that it is common, he exploits the ambiguity of her pronoun, it, and builds upon that bawdy association of the word common, which in the 17th century suggested prostitution. Prostitutes were sometimes called common women because they were held in common by all men, and a brothel full of such women was called a common house. So the invective sense of his reply, then, depends upon our pronoun referent, which is ambiguous. And of course, Hamlet's exploiting that ambiguity. To what does it refer? Does it refer to the death of the father, as Gertrude ostensibly intended, or does it refer to her marriage and subsequent alliance with Claudius? Repeatedly, the prince appropriates the language of other characters as a kind of weapon, sometimes, as we see here, to a scathing effect. Of course, this sort of linguistic appropriation is more than just a weapon for Hamlet. It's also a kind of a tool for constructing his own subjectivity, as we previously noted. Who is Hamlet? Well, he explores this question in response to Gertrude's next query. If it be so, why seems it so particular with thee? The question prompts a 10-line dissertation on the subject of grief, which also happens to kiss against one of the essential themes of the tragedy. What does it mean to be human? Hamlet begins this dissertation, true to form, by appropriating Gertrude's line, specifically her use of the verb seems, to denote his expression of grief. Hamlet replies, quote, "Seems, madam, nay it is, I know not seems," thus underscoring the sincerity of his own grief in implicit contrast to the performative aspect of Gertrude's. He catalogs his various expressions and notes their inadequacy to express something so essential as grief. The forms, moods, and shapes of grief cannot denote him truly because they are actions that a man might play. While the essential part of man, what Hamlet calls that which passeth show, can only be experienced, can never be properly represented. So is there an allegory for dramatic art embedded in these lines? Perhaps. But if the actor's costume and gesture cannot convey true human experience of grief, for example, his language can come somewhat nearer, forcing the audience not only to note his experience, but by virtue of the intellectual effort necessary to follow his rhetoric, to create that experience for themselves as well. So, as I near the end of my time today, I ought to apply this analysis to my initial question of why Shakespeare matters. In 2001, Norman Augustine, the former CEO of Lockheed Martin, authored a book titled Shakespeare in Charge: The Bard's Guide to Leading and Succeeding on the Business Stage, which attempted to glean management lessons from Shakespeare's plays. E.g., Claudius in Hamlet is an effective crisis manager, while Macbeth is less so. That was one of his actual sentiments, and that was one that stuck in my mind. I found the book an amusing read myself, but I remain unconvinced that that's where Shakespeare's real value lies. The study of Shakespeare does not directly teach one how to build a business or split an atom or treat disease. That's not why Shakespeare matters. Shakespeare matters because learning to read and understand Shakespeare is something akin to intellectual exercise, like intellectual calisthenics. As we've just seen, it requires the mind to stretch and process meaning in ways other than the ways to which we are accustomed. In short, it requires us to think critically. And I believe that this is why most university English majors, more than 90% of them, find employment within a year of graduation. Skills necessary to analyze literature generally, and I would argue for Shakespeare specifically, are skills which will prove useful in a variety of professional contexts. They are the same kinds of skills which allow one to write and improvise computer code, or to develop advertising campaigns, or design efficient automobiles. They are the kind of skills which, as the late Steve Jobs noted, combine with technology to make our hearts sing. In short, there is a clear benefit to the study of Shakespeare if the purpose of education is to teach students not merely how to do a single job or how to prepare for a trade, but rather how to think and adapt in abstract ways, developing the kind of skills which are broadly applicable in a variety of disciplines, all the while reflecting productively on those things that make us human. Thank you so much for hosting me today, folks. Thank you.